Hello there, and welcome to episode 50?
Is it? Did it sneak up on us?
50th podcast?
Like 5-0? Well, we used to do something fun. Unfortunately,
oh,
we did
not schedule
anything interesting
No.
for this podcast.
I think it's 50. Yeah.
Wow, we made it.
We did it.
We really done it.
We did 50 whole episodes of
50
nonsense.
Episodes. Yeah, I don't know what what's the point. Call in, readers, and tell us what the point of this podcast has been.
Yeah.
Because sometimes,
what has this podcast meant to you?
It's ambiguous to us.
Right.
I think overall, the people that listen to us are parents, some players, some general industry, baseball and strength training people.
But my friends listen to it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yep, that's what I said.
What do they think?
I said, please don't. I don't know what they thought. Of course they're going to tell me they like it, but they're my friends.
They actually like it, yeah. So we plan to start with a story today.
Yeah, I don't know what the story's about.
I mentioned this on my Snapchat. I've been trying to... we just hit our good schedule for the fall where we have time. I'm just getting my social media stuff collected, and that means some of these like feeds and these stories, whatever. So I was walking home from a coffee shop 2 days ago, and I'm walking under this tree, and it has all these like big green leaves that are on the sidewalk. And I'm walking, and then I slip, and I turn back, and I try to figure out, what did I just slip on? And at that moment, you could have like a list, right? There'd
right.
be like a, what are the most probable options?
Yeah,
and, like,
banana peel.
And it was a half of a pickle.
Half of a pickle?
Yeah. And I found it just really weird, and I had this stupid philosophical musing about it.
Yeah, I was going to say, I wish I would have been inside your head.
Like, how many people have stepped on a pickle in their life?
Right. Yeah.
And it was extremely slippery. I mean, I don't know about you, but as a kid, this whole banana peel business is on the cartoons.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, I don't think that's really that slippery. And I tested this out, and it's really not. Like, it just has too much grip in there, like between the peel, the outer peel.
Coefficient of friction is too high.
It depends on the surface, but really it's more about the surface than anything.
Right.
But you can't just throw a banana peel down.
Yeah, if you're running
pavement,
away from the cops, you can't, like, throw a banana peel.
No, it's not a, you're not a squid. This is not an ink screen or a smoke screen or any sort of James Bond-esque gadget.
Yeah, just spraying oil on the road.
However, this pickle was A, gross. It was disgusting. It looked like a huge green slug. And it was extremely slippery.
What's that pickle story?
I don't know. How did that pickle get there? I talked to one of our girls at the academy about it yesterday. And she's like, you know, you eat that for lunch. Like, that's not a big deal. It's like, she doesn't eat pickles. But she's like, you know, I just like... She's like, that doesn't seem super uncommon to me. And I'm like, I don't feel like I can recall a time where I saw a pickle on the ground.
Maybe people who don't eat pickles just like toss them into the world when they don't want them.
Plus, not red herring, but black swan. It was like a half a pickle. It wasn't like a quarter. Like if you went and got a sandwich somewhere.
Oh, yeah.
You wouldn't get a half a pickle.
Yeah, it's either you get a whole pickle or you get a quarter pickle.
Yeah.
You get a spear.
The plot thickens.
Yeah, yeah.
So
that pickle was left there.
So this was a residential. It was a residential pickle, not a commercial pickle.
Right.
Someone brought that from their house.
Made that pickle.
Which buying a half a pickle, I feel like, is still a weird. Is that weird? I feel like that's still weird.
Do they even sell half pickles? I feel like you either buy a whole pickle or you buy a spear.
The quarter spear, yeah. I don't. These are good questions.
I don't think they make half pickles. Does Jimmy John serve a half pickle?
Well, you don't get a pickle with a sandwich. Maybe.
I think you can.
I mean,
I don't go to Jimmy John's often enough, but.
Yeah, why do people like Jimmy John's?
I don't know.
Go into this with us.
What's that?
Let's go into the philosophy of Jimmy John's right now.
I think, here's what I think the allure of Jimmy John's is. It's fast, and I think it has the illusion of being, like, not bad for you. Well, I mean, not that it's bad.
It's definitely fast. I'm impressed by their speed. I will be completely honest about that.
But you're like,
a great job with that.
When you're in a pickle, and you have to find some food quick, and you don't want to go to McDonald's or I think Subway's disgusting, or any of those fast food places, and you can like Jimmy John's is a respite from the fast food thing. You can still feel good about yourself, and then you get it in less than like 2 minutes. I think that's why people convince themselves that they like it.
Yeah, that's what, like, if you eat Jimmy John's, like, I'm okay with that. But when people are like, oh, yeah, I love Jimmy John's. Like, no.
No one loves
it.
You don't.
Like, you could make that sandwich yourself in 5 seconds.
Also,
well, they could probably make it faster than that. But
also, people say that they like their bread, and I don't like their bread. I like their wheat bread.
Their wheat bread, the square bread.
I like that one.
That's, like, a pretty decent bread. But
the white one is gross.
the like the sub roll.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's terrible.
It's like rubbery.
Why would I want
like
to
super
eat that?
Hard.
It's horrible. Yeah, so I don't know the allure of Jimmy John's. How do we get on the topic of Jimmy John's?
Because I think they might serve a half pickle with their sandwiches. I'm trying to remember. So then
I don't eat in enough, but
easily have been a Jimmy John's patron. They put their pickle in their pocket to eat for later. Didn't know they had a hole in their pocket. Pickle slips out. Boom.
There's a Jimmy John's 3 or 4 blocks from that location.
Uh-oh. We're going to Sherlock Holmes this.
But I don't know. That's not, I have eaten in a Jimmy John's in the last 2 months.
Mm-hmm.
Indicator. I don't recall. I don't know if I got
think
a pickle.
You can, I think
I don't
you
know
a
if I did or not. I don't.
You can request one.
Interesting. Interesting. But, you know, you just think back of, like, as you're about to turn, and if someone said, like, Dan, freeze. Guess what that thing you stepped on was.
What did you just slip on, Dan?
What number do you think pickle would have been?
Pickle would have been low. Pickle would
like
have been
20, like 2,711.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know what. Like, you go down a list of foods.
A lot of, yeah,
and
foods
really
are like.
If you really thought about it, it'd be like easily discardable, one-hand edible foods.
Right.
Pickles, there's, I guess, high up on that list.
Yeah,
but
you
not
also,
that high.
You, I feel like you, if you see someone walking down the street, like eating a banana, eating an apple, like eating even a carrot, like there's a lot of things you could like see someone walking down the street and you're like, that's not weird. But someone like munching on a pickle while they're walking down the street is kind of weird.
Yeah, and I would have seen the carrot. Like, if it was big enough for me to step on, like, a carrot's like a road cone, basically.
Right.
A dry, scraggly.
Yeah.
The worst. What was the old carrot facts?
Like, was there one on a road cone?
Yeah. He had a picture of a road cone, and it said, that's biggest cab route I ever saw. For those of you who don't know, there's a Twitter account called Real Carrot Facts. And if you are feeling down today, whatever today ends up being when you listen to this, you should go on Twitter and read Real Carrot Facts, because there's three themes. Number one, carrots. Number two, misspellings. Like, he just spells carrot like a different way every time. Cabrot, carrot.
And number three is unrequited love.
And number three is unrequited love. Do you want to go into the Megan story?
I think
we talked about this
like
episode 15 or
it's
something.
It's like
a long
the running
time
joke
ago.
In our podcast is that we always
Real
talk
Carrot
about.
Carrot Facts are amazing.
No, it's just the reason it's so great. Well, my personal experience with it is when Dan introduced me to it, I was reading through it, and my first, I don't know, dozen were just like the first two. So like funny misspellings and then like funny interpretations of carrot facts. And then, I don't know, I had to have gotten through at least a dozen, maybe like two dozen. And then there was this one about, I don't remember, my recollection isn't as good as yours, but there was one where he slips in this little nugget about Megan, his ex-girlfriend, and I was like, wait, what? I don't get that. And then you read like 5 or 6 more, and there's another like slip in about Megan, and you're like, what? Okay. And then you get deep enough into his like tweets, and Megan comes up every like 6 tweet, and it's amazing. It'll be like carrots are, I'm paraphrasing, but it'll be like carrots are,
oh, you don't need to paraphrase. I'm
dry and delicious, I miss Megan. And they're just, I would love to meet the guy who, I'm assuming he's anonymous. Like, do we know who Carrot Man is?
All right, so update. We thought that it seemed that Carrot Facts had, like, died out at some point. However, there are some new ones as of July. Now, it's been over a month since July. We're taping this on August 28th. But the most recent two tweets. Second most recent, it just says crat.
C-R-A-T. Crat.
The next recent, so the last tweet of this, like, 6 week sabbatical, it says Croatia.Megan. That's it. Now, this is not going to be funny to you.
Yeah. We know up front that you're not going to find this enjoyable.
But then just like, let's go through some of these. So July 9th, my favorite thing. Guess what it is? Carrot. Yes, you guess it. July 8th, if you feel bad, think about good thing in life, like a carrot or an orange stick with a green stem at the end could help. No punctuation. 7/8/18, mega, space, N. 10/30/2017. So again, there was a long sabbatical. there's just, it says Monday hashtag, and there is a photo of a cat with a carrot on its head.
Cat with its eyes closed, with a carrot on its head.
Yeah, let's just give the readers here in YouTube land the taste of that sweet picture.
those two most recent are amazing.
They're very good.
Crat.
Let's see. Carrots don't move if you put them on a chair and just watch for 4 hours before going to Rite Aid for Neosporin and milk.
Or this one. Carrot are good and taste good. Donald Trump should not be president.
We can do this all day. But back to the pickle here. So
yeah. Let's get to the real issue at hand.
I just don't know that a reasonable person could possibly step on
there has
pickle
to be,
and turn around and think, was that a pickle I stepped on?
There has to be a name for that phenomenon where, like, well, I'm sure there is, but just I can very much picture in the moment when you slipped and then were like, oh, what was that? And like turned around and like the minute you saw it was a pickle, like your mind was blown. There has to be a name for whatever that realization is, but
you say my mind was pickled?
yeah. You had a Chris Angel mind pickle.
Yeah, and it's just it's interesting the way you expect things to be. Another common phenomenon, which is not confusing, but is just the heavy door phenomenon. It's super irritating when you walk in a building. You know, you push a door and you walk right through, and then you expect automatically, which is kind of interesting that your body learns to do this, that your body learns that when you open a normal door, and it's probably a higher pressure for a commercial door, lesser pressure for a house, and you, like, know that my body exerts 17 pounds or whatever to, like, push open a door. And then when you hit one of those doors that's, like, one of the automatic ones that's geared, and you try to push it open, and it just, like, doesn't move, or you try to pull it open, you're, like, you're a grown strong man. You, like, can't – you look like an idiot in front of other people because you can't pull this door open. It's just strange how you just expect things automatically and just do things so autonomously.
Door story for you. At U of I, at the undergrad library, if you were a U of I alum, this will resonate with you. But there were these doors with these – they're big glass pane doors with these big, like, basically floor-to-ceiling metal handles that you'd pull. Handles and they were the heaviest door that I've ever experienced. But the annoying thing about them was they had no – like, typically when you open a door, there's like a hydraulic mechanism that you can't just like swing it and it smashes against the wall. But these did not have that. So you had to create an incredible amount of force to like get it open. But then once it got going, because of inertia, it would just like fling into the wall. So it was like these really massive, I think of it just as like medieval castle doors. So like these enormous doors that take an incredible amount of force to get started. But once you get them going, you're not gonna like slow them down. And so it was just the worst. Plus it was, at U of I, it was windy like 90% of the year. So you're like battling in the wind and you had to like really like give these suckers a go to get them going, and they just like smash into the wall. It was crazy.
Who designed that? That's,
yeah, so U of I is one of the best engineering schools in the world.
Yeah, no one like figures that out.
Yeah, maybe they fixed it since then, but.
That seems baffling. Topic that got lost, I believe, in our Ghost Cast last week.
Yeah, Ghost Cast.
So I was talking to our
Hashtag Ghost Cast 2018.
Our strength training, our strength coach, Connor, yesterday.
Connor.
Who we had a long coffee morning. And he was talking about his CSCS exam.
Oh.
Which we decided he's going to make a date for and get that higher level certification. And in our Ghost Cast, we brought up how you only got one A minus in your whole college career. So we talked about school, I think, a lot in the last one, right?
Yes.
Can you go into how is it that you do that? How did you only get, like, what, talk on your studying methods, because there's a lot of people that will pass some higher level nursing exam or PT exam or strength training exam or whatever. What is your, I'm sure you have some very efficient way of studying. Go into it now. Mic drop.
I do have a very efficient way of studying that I don't know if I would recommend it to most people, because basically here's what I would always do. I never miss class, so I go to all the classes. I like take like okay notes. I really just like to sit and listen more than anything. But when it came time for exams, I've always been a really, really good exam or test taker. And my study strategy has always been smash as much into my brain in the, depending on the time scale, but in the 12 hours prior, and then just like regurgitate it all in the exam, which is not, if you'll read anything about learning or memory, not a good way to maintain long-term information. But it's, for me, I was super good at collecting it and then spitting it out in a 6-hour time frame. So, like in college, pretty regularly, my semesters would go like this. Never miss class, go to all the classes, do all the assignments. I do well on all the assignments. So I'd usually have pretty good get grades going into the finals. And then the finals were, the way it works in college, obviously, if you haven't been, is you have, let's say you have 5 classes. There's a week devoted to finals. So you might have a final, one final Monday at 3 p.m. You have a final at 8 a.m. on Wednesday and 6 p.m. on Wednesday, and then a final on Friday or something like that. And so it's nice because you can go, all right, I have my final on Monday. I'm going to study all day Sunday. And so I would just go and I'd pretty much read the textbook and smash as much information into my brain. And then I would just close my book, go get a bunch of sleep, wake up and just puke it all out on the exam. And so I did that pretty much all through college. And then when I did the CSCS, here's how I studied for the CSCS. I bought the text that all the exam is based on. And the first time through, I read the textbook from cover to cover without taking notes, without really thinking too hard about it. I just read it.
But define read it. I mean, did you really closely read this or did you skim this?
No, the first time through basically was skimming. But when I saw something that I was curious about or knew, felt like I didn't know anything about, I read that chapter. So like the first chapter in the CSCS textbook is all the really granular mechanics behind muscle contraction. So you're talking about, you like go into T-tubules and calcium ions and all this stuff. So I read that pretty closely. But then there's stuff like, I don't know. I don't want to say like, there's some like spotting stuff and some program design stuff that I was like, yeah. So I read that all the way through. Then the second time through, I read it again. And I took note cards, which there's a reason that everyone in the world does flashcards. It's because I think they're pretty, for me, they're pretty effective at, you know, you have a word or a concept and then a definition on the back. And then I would either go, I'd read the backs and give the term on the front or read the term on the front and give the definition. So I read the textbook twice. Well, one was a skim. Second one was, again, another kind of skim, but stuff that I was unsure about, I made a flashcard for. And then really, I was like, oh, I'm gonna set a timeline for, you know, 3 months out. I'm going to start studying, like, blah, blah, blah. But I really didn't even start studying for it until probably like a month before I knew I was going to take the exam. And then I did most of my studying in that month and most of the heavy studying in the 2 weeks prior. But like my strategy was just a short time period before whatever I'm going to be tested on, I'm just going to slam. And I'm going to, like, I'm getting the... well, I'm hoping to get the certification from the International Society of Sports Nutrition. And that exam is supposed to be pretty difficult as well. But it's the same thing where it's like they have position stands. So they have these articles that say, here's what the International Society of Sports Nutrition says about creatine. Here's what it says about caffeine intake. Here's what it says about meal frequency. And they say, read all these, memorize them, because you're going to be quizzed on it. And so I'm going to probably do the same thing for that as well, where I need just to like figure out a test date. I'm going to mark out a month before and then just like smash all the information into my brain.
So, for everyone out there, you got what on the CSCS? You got like a 90?
90%.
Like that, mm-hmm. Which is very high for that test because the bar is what, 70% is passing? And you get certified?
70%. Mm-hmm.
Something like that. But widely known as a very difficult test.
Yeah, I think 60% of people fail it on their first attempt.
Yeah. So, takeaway from this, I thought, like, I didn't know what his method was before I asked this question. Takeaway is, he read the friggin' textbook twice, so there's, like, no shortcut. I mean, you had a 4.0 in high school,
mm-hmm.
and nearly a 4.0 in college.
Mm-hmm.
You only got an A- in one class. Everything else was an A or above.
I think two A-. Right, everything else was an A above.
It's growing. His whole thing is unraveling. But
yeah, yeah.
But
oh, I did fail those two classes.
But this is a clear example of why. And people are always looking for, like, oh, how can I hack this? How can I hack that? He read the textbook two freaking times. Like, two times. This is a thick textbook. This is a 600-page textbook. And it's not interesting at all. It's not relevant to much of the real world, hardly, at all.
No. And you have to... I don't know. I was going to say swallow your pride. That's not it. But, like, one of the things they'll recommend is if you have been a trainer... Because I was training with you before I took the CSCS. So they'll say if you've already been a trainer, you kind of have to, like, work backwards a little bit because there might be stuff on the CSCS that conflicts with methodology that you have. And so I thought that was interesting too, where it's like, just you can't go, let's see,
Just remember everything in this textbook is completely impractical and you won't use in real life, so make sure you mesh that with the stuff that you add that's actually important.
Well, yeah, because it'll be like let's say program design, for example, or there's a whole thing on nutrition where you can be like, I know nutrition, like I'll skip that chapter, but you don't know if that's what the NSCA, their guidelines on nutrition, if they are in line with yours. So you kind of have to, like, pretend like you know nothing, even if you think you know some stuff, just so that you can answer correctly on what you're actually being tested on.
Yeah. So obviously there's other ways to study for things, and there's potentially ways to, like, hack it. There's different tests on, or, like, there's a testing app for that test on iOS devices, whatever. You can just quiz yourself over and over and over. It kind of gives you the question and answer format. But at the end of the day,
one of my favorite things,
textbook twice.
Yeah. I mean, textbook twice. And then I did study those flashcards for an inordinate amount of time. I probably went through them.
Not inordinate, but an inordinate.
I would say probably 7 or 8 times of just, like, and there was, like, a stack like this when I would just, like, burn through those. I also find, like, to your point, the what always kills me is because I've toyed around in the last couple of years. I'm like, I want to learn a foreign language. And so you have all these, you know, like Duolingo, like I use that, like all these apps or these, like, podcasts and stuff like that, where it's like, learn Spanish in 8 months. And it's just like, there's no way. Like, you can't, there's, people are always looking for ways to hijack, like you said, like, what's the word I want? Oh, like, hack the system in terms of, like, information gathering. And you just, like, especially when it comes to foreign language, which is, like, the ultimate form of learning new information, there's just, like, no way to do it.
Yeah, well, and I know, I remember, and I think everyone's got this, everyone who knows who Tim Ferriss is probably has a different opinion of Tim Ferriss. I think he's mostly a fraud, but he is interesting, for sure. Gives you good things to ponder on.
Just out of curiosity, when you say fraud, what do you think he claims to be?
I think a lot of his book is just full of garbage. It's full of
the 4-hour work week.
It's full of things that are just not, just patently untrue. Like the four hour body, like he's talking about this thing where his, like, dad or someone was just eating 30 grams of protein every morning and put on 20 pounds in a month. It's like,
what?
That just, like, doesn't make sense, dude. Like, all these, like, he did this one workout where it was like he did like 30 minutes of mostly eccentric exercise and put on 20 pounds of muscle in a month. It's like, just stop. Like, that didn't happen probably. And it's not going to happen for other people. And there's just, like, so much of that where it just, all of his books just get really blurry, where you're like, well, this is clearly garbage. This is clearly not true. This clearly wouldn't work for anyone else if it worked for you at all, which I doubt that it did. So then, like, what do you believe from all that? And I've read The 4-Hour Body. I've read The 4-Hour Chef. I've not read The 4-Hour Work Week.
I read The 4-Hour Work Week.
And so I get a large dose of, like, the things that he just, like, spits out of his brain. I thought a lot of it was just garbage.
One of my favorite ones from, I think I told you this, one of my favorite ones from the 4-Hour Work Week, I read it when I was in college, and he was like, you know, it's all about, like, productivity, and your time is valuable, and blah, 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 blah. And so one of the things he recommends is, I can't remember if it's once or twice, but basically check your email no more than 2 times a day. So basically you, like, set out, like, I'm going to check my email at noon, and I'm going to check it at 5, and then I'm not going to look at it the rest of the day. And I was like, oh, yeah, that makes total sense. But now being, like, a working adult who has responsibilities and stuff, if you, just being as a fellow professional, if you only look at your email at noon every day, like, I think you're an asshole, because there's, like, responses I need semi quickly. And if you're only checking your email once a day, once every 24 hours, like, you definitely can't be on your email like 12 hours a day.
Correct.
But just to say, oh, I'm gonna check it from 12 to 12:30. And then if I don't see your email by that time, so if I send you an email at 12:45, it's not gonna get answered until the next day. It's like,
yeah,
but
not ideal. But anyway, my point of bringing him up was that he talked about speed reading and ways to, like,
yeah,
you know, he hack. I hate the word hack. I just really don't like it. But in speed reading, it's still like a similar thing where there's definitely some strategies that he didn't invent. And he doesn't claim to have invented them, but he just like shares lots of different stuff. And talks about how, you know, like, for example, like, there's 13 words in a line, and you read from end of the page to end of the page. You don't read from the true end to the true end. You start about, what, a quarter in? Because your peripheral will catch the first quarter. You read to the last quarter, and then your peripheral vision will catch that quarter. But you basically stay in the middle 67% of the book, something like that, or 50% of the book. And knowing that, just because, again, there's a field of vision. Like, if I look at my hand here, I can still see way over here. And I can still see way over here. So if you're looking at directly at every word, you're wasting use of your peripheral vision, which then your eyes can move faster. They can scan down the page quicker. And you also just have to force yourself to do it. But I think everyone wants to like speed read and learn to read faster so they can accomplish more. They can, you know, get through a textbook faster. These are like, it's a really important potential goal. However, I still don't think there's a substitute for, because I try this at different times. And like, oh, this makes sense. I'm doing it. But you still need to like focus on reading that way for a long period of time before it becomes normal.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you're like consciously thinking about how fast you're reading, and it doesn't just like naturally stick. Not like anything. And this is especially analogous to the sports world with command. Like, everyone's searching for command in baseball. Everyone's obsessed with velocity, but now people are talking about command a little bit more because they're realizing that velocity is not the only thing. And a lot of people who are obsessed with velocity can't throw a strike to save their lives, and that's not pitching. But they don't realize that there's not just like some shortcut thing either. It's not just like, oh, I throw to targets in my bullpen, so there, that's command training. Like, that's stupid. That's like, oh, great, you have a target, but that's not really the way it works. The way it works is an intense focus on every single pitch, feeling through your delivery, feeling through your release, and being incredibly determined about your outcome. I mean, it's really a mindset thing and a body control thing, feeling through your entire delivery, understanding this was a ball, this was a strike, how it felt, how, and then you learn how to make these subtle adjustments. But it's such a mind thing, because like my command got better every year, every year to my career as I like went up, despite a smaller strike zone as every level I increased. And it was because I realized and finally like knew how to do it consistently, because I'd focused enough. And saying the word focus is kind of broad, but when you start to do something, like you start to speed read and you stick with it long enough, then you just start to speed read naturally, and you can like maintain that pace, I assume. But like with command and pitching, this was not where I was going, but it was something that once I got into that level of like tunnel vision and process orientation, or whatever you call it, about like this pitch has got to go here and this is how I do it, and then over time that becomes normal, and then over time your command improves without really having like a really solid reason why. And it's like, for all that stuff, there's no way to like hack your command and suddenly like go from like walking 6 batters per 9 to 4 batters per 9. There's no like one mechanical tweak. It's like a paradigm shift in how you approach your task, what you're doing. I mean, imagine like shooting sports, like archery or darts, or obviously, did you say guns? I'm drawing a blank. I mean,
they probably call it like
rifling.
Yeah.
You know, but just shooting sports in general. When you first shoot, it's just like when it goes way high, you like miss your target by like 6 feet, and you learn over time like all these little things. And I mean, like, what makes one marksman able to hit something from like 1,000 yards out and someone not? I mean, besides like the little physical calculations and like clicking their dials and understanding wind and all that stuff, but like what makes someone a world-class marksman versus someone who's just like a good, you know, like deer hunter? Like, there's something right there, right? It's an intense thing that's like practiced over time that separates people. And I don't know, but in general, my long-term point with this was that like in reading the textbook 2 times and in speed reading and in finding a new language to learn, there really aren't shortcuts to a large degree. There's definitely, like, I've heard like with like one of the Tim Ferriss's things about learning a new language was that there's like, and I learned this in philosophy of language in college, that there's like something like 120 words that humans use. Like, most people only use like 120, and I don't know if that's the exact number.
It's low,
but it's a shocking, you're like, that can't be true.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a shockingly low amount of words that a person uses. And if you learn all those, like, you're going to become fluent faster than someone who's spending time on, you know, the word bloviate.
Right.
Who
right.
here knows what the word bloviate is? I think it's a great word. I've been bloviating on whatever I'm talking about for the last
skill acquisition.
Five minutes. But yeah, so, you know, just that's sort of like a, I'm not going to say the word hack, but.
Well, and so I have things to say. So basically, to boil down your point, is a universal truth is if you're looking for a new skill or to learn new information, that there is no shortcut to that process.
A permanent change, no.
There's nothing you can do. I have a couple things that I thought of while you were talking. First of all, I went to a speed reading workshop in college, and there were several things that the woman in charge was saying. I remember three of them, two of which I thought were really bizarre and didn't help me at all, and one of which did. The first two were, she said, like, because we've all done this, that when you're reading a book and you kind of space out and you're like, oops, I wasn't paying attention to the last two sentences. And you go back and read them again. And then you're like, oh, well, I still kind of wasn't paying attention. And you go, so she was like, first of all, never do that. She's like, if you're reading and you kind of like space out for a couple of sentences, she's like, just understand the fact that you got distracted, refocus, and you just keep moving on. And I was like, well, that's interesting because I like miss complete.
I've missed pages. Philosophy and so, reading was terrible in college.
I'll be like, oh my gosh. So I have to go back and read it again. And because if I don't, then I just like, that information never got processed in a deeper way. And I can't remember what her justification was, but it was something to the effect of like, imagine you're watching someone lecture and, you know, they're lecturing, you're engaged, blah, blah, blah. And then you kind of like space out for a second. She's like, imagine if that person went back and repeated the last three things they said like three or four times in a row and then continued on. She's like, the breaking up the flow of the narrative like kind of ruins it. And I was like, well, I don't see how that tracks. And then along those same lines, another one was, she was like, this was like in a workshop geared towards college students. And she was like, don't highlight. She's like, if you have a textbook or text and you're highlighting passages or sentences, she's like, don't do that. Because, and again, I can't exactly remember what the justification was, but it was along those same lines of like your brain processes information in a certain way and the flow of reading straight through benefits that process. And I was like, oh, okay, whatever. But the last one that she did was, and I'm sure you've run into this at some point, is using your finger to govern your eye movement. So like you'll see people who do like the real speed readers will do this when they're like reading down a page. And so basically you use your like index finger and your middle finger and you underline the sentences as you're going, and basically what your finger does is helps to dictate the speed at which your eye is moving. So like your finger kind of dictates how the flow of your eyes, which again, it was one of those things that you have to practice it, but the couple times that I gave effort to it, I do think that kind of helped my eye move across the page a little bit quicker.
Yeah,
because that's one of the things that, like, you're alluding to, that, you know, most people when they're reading, their eye is moving slower than they could actually process information. Like if they could get their eyes to move faster, they would pick up that information. So most of us just aren't very good at doing that unless you read a whole ton. So that was one of the things that helped me. But
and then yeah, I had another thing. And people think that reading slower is like better for reading comprehension. But
I could see that
isn't true from what I've heard, or at least from the speed reading people. That they said that isn't really true. That you don't really retain more. They've done studies on it. I guess I don't know.
Oh well, I guess so. In terms of, so let's say you have a ceiling of, I can read X amount of words per minute. That person slowing down, do you think that'd be beneficial or detrimental to comprehension or have no effect at all?
Because
there are times.
I guess it's hard to quantify that statement. Does that mean like, I'm a slow reader, it helps me? Because that's sort of just a statement someone would say with no evidence. Or slowing down a fast reader, do they retain more?
Right. If you're operating submaximally under your max reading limit, I wonder what effect that has on comprehension. Like you said, there's no way that you could quantify that, but, or maybe you could, I don't know. But there are times where I'll purposely slow myself down, especially like during, I don't know that this is the same exact thing as comprehension, but, or retention, but I'll like slow myself down on, particularly if it's a meaningful passage or like a technically difficult passage, I'll slow myself down to like improve my ability to understand what the hell's going on. But yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, and I don't know, from that lecture analogy, and I think that's tough to argue to well, argue, to argue with things. Analogies, yeah, it's like, so say you're lecturing, you're saying, here are the five colors a house could be. They could be red, they could be blue, they could be green, you space out. They could be yellow, they could be orange.
Right.
And you just missed yellow.
A yellow, orange.
Like,
yeah.
You only have four.
Right.
Like, and that's just how it is, unfortunately. Like, you miss something, you just, like, the same thing for skipping class. You're just skipping a micro piece of it. I don't think that's a relevant. And I understand, like, when you finish a book, you're like, okay, I remember three things. Where did the other 40,000 words go?
That's the most.
So I get that part of it, too, but I don't know.
If you could, if I could, you give me the choice between increasing my reading speed by 100% or increasing my comprehension or retention by 50%, I would take retention. I take 10% on retention. Like, it's just like, that for that, that's so frustrating to me that, especially with some of these, because I'm a big history guy, so I'll read a lot of biographies, and they're always pretty dense, and they're pretty long, and I'll get done with a book this thick, and I'll be like, oh, man, I remember that one time that guy did that one thing, and that's all I can remember. I'm like, damn it.
Yeah, I went on a baseball trip recently with another philosophy major. One of the other coaches in my Dominican trip was also a philosophy major, and he remembered lots of philosophy stuff.
Yeah.
I was a fraud. Yeah. I don't remember any of it. That's just not how my brain works. I don't know.
Well, and it's like, I remember I mentioned to you at one point that I wanted to learn French or learn Spanish or something like that, and you were like, yeah, you know, it's that'd be cool, but there's just like, you have no... In order to keep information in your head, you have to activate that section of your brain over and over and over.
Yes.
And it's like, even if I was to sit down and spend, you know, 6 months learning Spanish, I don't have anybody to speak Spanish to. So I'm never going to be able to retain that information. So you go to school for philosophy and I go to school for advertising, and then we get 2 years removed and we don't use that information anymore. It's just goodbye information.
Bye-bye.
Yeah. So that's a frustrating part.
Yeah, and we talked about that because our screensaver for our main computer here is currently showing the word of the day, which is, or the word of the minute or whatever. It just keeps going through words. That last one was composure, which is not a very big word.
But there was a great one up there the other
day. Kids have like no vocabulary these days, and maybe they've never had a vocabulary. I don't know if you talk to a 15-year-old 15 years ago what their vocabulary was like, but kids don't know what any words are.
And simple words.
Yeah, and you and I both cherish words, and I like learning new ones because they're like getting a piece of electronics, where a piece of electronics allows you to do more tasks faster. You know, you have a good word that replaces other words. It has more meaning and less utterance. But anyway, like the word apologue. What is an apologue? I don't know. I can't read it from here. Just beneath the limit of my pretty good vision. But
a moral fibble?
What? Moral fable?
Fable? Maybe that's what it was. A moral fable.
Context, kids. Context. But anyway... We talked about this in the past that, like, if you're learning, so we both read the Wall Street Journal when we can see the articles when they're not
behind a paywall.
Yeah. And I love the Wall Street Journal because the writers have great vocabulary. Like, you read an article, you learn a new word, like, on almost every single one. It's really impressive. They're really great writers. And there's some great ones in the New York Times and other places, but the Wall Street Journal just feels more like vocabulary dense to me than any other publication that I've read. I don't read the heavy financial stuff. I read all sorts of stuff. But if you read a lifestyle article on Yahoo, you read a similar lifestyle article
USA
on Wall Street
Today.
Journal or wherever, it's just like way denser from like, anyway. So we were talking about vocabulary words probably a couple of years back. And it's like, if you don't have someone in your life or other people in your life, like these kids in high school all seem to not know any words. You're just like stuck in the same bubble of the same 120 words that humans use. You know what I mean? And we both have one of our mutual long-term friends and supporters, Jim Connect, the judge from here in town. And we're always like excited to talk to Jim because we learn new words. And he knows that we have an affinity for words. So
he'll
teach us some and challenges you to, like, the word bloviate, I learned from Jim.
Right. And the other good thing about Jim is you can... The new words you acquire, you can use, and you know he'll know what the heck. Because that's the other bummer is you can have a great vocabulary, but if they're all going to fall flat on your audience, then it's just like, well, this is completely inefficient. Like, I learned these words to be flowery and efficient, and this isn't working.
And you don't want to be insulting either. You don't want to be, you know, make people feel like they're stupid either. Like, I think we both teach kids words a lot in our lessons, but yeah, like Jim would come in and he would since he knows sometimes he'll go on one of his diatribes where he's bloviating on a topic.
right.
And he'll just like give us an old word.
Yeah, there'll be some nuggets in there
that he learned when he was, you know, 90 years younger and and is no longer in circulation anymore. But
back in 1887,
still good words. Jim's a great guy. Jim, we love you. But I mean, yeah, it's like your bubble. Like if we wanted to learn Spanish, it would be very difficult to learn without having someone to speak it to.
Right. And it's like, that's what,
for sure.
And that's one of my favorite analogies. I think I stole it from Ben Bruno, but, you know, cause one of the things we talk about with, like our exercise science interns that we get in strength training.
Ben Bruno's a personal trainer out in California. Really like good trainer.
Yeah. One of the most probably renowned personal trainers, at least in America. And he, so one of the things you talk about when you have like an exercise science intern is, you know, they have all this, or one of the common criticisms of exercise science degrees is you get all this great technical knowledge, but you have no real world application. And so one of my favorite analogies is Ben Bruno talks about, okay, well, let's say you have two strength trainers and two people speaking Spanish. Two people speaking Spanish, one is learning all of their Spanish from a textbook in a classroom, and the other person learned their Spanish, or let's say they're in a class for 6 months, and the other person spends 6 months in Spain. Who's going to be better at Spanish? And the answer is clear. And his argument, and there's obviously exceptions to this, what is, you have two trainers, one that spends 6 months reading a textbook on how to train people, and one spends 6 months training people, who's going to be the better trainer? So it's like,
yep.
It's just like, yeah, the best way to learn information is just to like get into it. And just like dive in, even if it's as, what do they call that when you have a
immersion?
Yeah, immersion. There you go.
Yeah. And you learn things, and hopefully you do things, you know, and it takes some caution. Like you got to err cautiously, obviously, with strength training because it's very different than language. Like you're going to hurt somebody with language. But, you know, one of the things I learned, early, just an example early on in my career was I learned med ball push ups from one of my mentors. I was an intern for about a year, this guy named Nick Tumanello, who speaks all over the world on personal training. And he liked doing some circuits where you do push-ups with, like, your hand on a med ball, right? If you're in the fitness room, you've probably seen someone doing those. I'm like, oh, these are great. Like, some instability for your shoulder, like, they have their place. If you do them more than, like, once or twice a week, guess what starts to hurt? Wrists. Like, a large percentage of kids start to, like, hey, Dan, like, can I do something different than those? Like, my wrists are really bugging me because your wrist is like this the whole time, and you're stabilizing. And there's things like that you would never, ever learn. And you never think, like, if I wrote a book on strength training, which I probably never will, I would never put that piece of information in there. Maybe as, like, an example.
Yeah.
But if you're going through the list of things, like, hey, don't do these things, it just wouldn't come up. But in a practical application where you're programming, like, say one of our strength coaches, like, writing out a workout, taking a kid through it, I'd be like, you know, and I see something like that, I'd be like, hey, just so you know, like, this volume of this exercise seems good on paper. But in real life, you're probably going to get some complaints about their knee hurting or their wrist hurting. Yeah. So one of my probably, you know, nip that before you get there.
One of my favorites is the barbell RDL chin-up superset. Try to do chin-ups and barbell RDL in the same superset. There's just like, there's no way you can do it because it fries your grip to the point that you can do neither your RDLs nor your chin-ups after your, like, first set. But that's something that you would never think about. You're like, oh, I want to do an RDL with, like, a back exercise. Those are the two, like, best ones you can do.
Yeah.
But they just don't pair well together for that reason.
Yeah, because on paper, you're like, you know, you do supersets with upper body, and then so while your upper body's resting, a la the chin up, your lower body's working. But like you said, those two are both so grip intensive that your hands give out, and that's just the weak link in the chain.
Yeah.
And there's lots of stuff like that. Something like if you do, like I was doing sliding leg curls yesterday, like I worked out.
Hey, good job.
Right? After I did some front squats, and like my back was just like really
fried,
tight while I was doing that. So there's just like stuff like that you kind of learn over time, or you don't want to give too many hamstring exercises before doing something that's really hamstring intensive later that they might just start to cramp and just be like really uncomfortable and not get much out of it. So it's just, that takes a lot of massaging and experience over time.
I had an interesting experience working with my baseball guys the other day. We were testing and I wanted to do a 3 rep max in front squat, and I would just like calculate their 1 rep max because I didn't feel like we needed to do 1 rep max. And we were doing front squat, and I was like, you know, I know most of you guys have probably front squatted in here before, but just to let you know, I would prefer that everybody does cross arm grip, which like this, versus like your clean style or Olympic style front squat. You have the bar in a front rack position like that. And I was like, you know, I think we should all be doing that, but if you fight me on it and you've been squatting, front squatting with a clean style grip since you were 10, like whatever. But just to let you know, like it puts arguably a little less stress on your elbows, but definitely less stress through your wrists and through your forearms. And so sure enough, probably like half the guys switched to the cross arm, but another half were still staying in that like traditional front rack style. And they're just like blown up in their like wrists and forearms. And I was like, well, that's kind of the reason that we do that is, especially as baseball players, and like your flexor mass, this thing on the front of your forearm and in your wrist, that just requires a ton of mobility through there to like do that safely and without pain. And they didn't really have it. So I think I converted a lot of guys to the cross arm style front squat.
Yeah. And final thought as we wrap up here is, I actually had that same conversation with a kid that I'm working with from Chicago. He's rehabbing his labrum. He's at 7 months. And he had a growth plate fracture in his elbow a couple years ago at his first Division I university. He's transferring to a new one now. And he said that they were all taught first, you know, freshman orientation to front squat with, you know, the rack position. And they front squatted like three times a week for like the first 3 months they were there. And
yikes.
He had a lot of elbow pain after that. Went to the doctor, and the doctor's like, well, what have you been doing? Like, you haven't been throwing that much? Like, it doesn't seem like there's a like, obviously, fall baseball, but he's like, it seems like there's probably a combination, like a confluence of factors.
Mm-hmm.
And he explains that they've been front squatting that way a ton. And he's like, that's probably it. So just anecdotal evidence. And like, I've had people email me and say they've gotten Tommy John from cleans. In the CrossFit world, that's becoming a more popular, not popular, but common injury. That cleaning so much can tear your UCL because of the way this throws back like that. And there's a lot of pressure on that joint. And if you're pitching, that's obviously a precious joint.
And I want to say that there's been some like people out there who go, oh, you know, there's no like, you know, scientific evidence that it puts more like stress through your UCL or in your elbow. And it's like, well, it's that's when research and practical applications sort of butt heads. It's like, I don't care if there is or not. I have people who I've literally seen get elbow or forearm or wrist pain from doing it. So like, why am I gonna do it?
Yeah, and that's why I have an issue with a lot of like, there's a whole movement and there's a lot of different, it depends who you follow on social media, but some people are like, oh, pitchers should do everything. Why aren't they bench pressing like crazy? Why aren't they deadlifting 600 pounds? Like, well, again, like 5 years ago, I went through this where a lot of my pitchers, as the season was getting closer, were doing a lot of farmer's walks, a lot of things with heavy pulling and holding, and a lot of barky elbows, like when they're throwing their bullpens. And the next year, when we hit that same phase of the year, when I really decreased the volume of those things, like almost no complaints. So it's just like, okay, there's no research study, but pretty sure I figured out the variable. Because a similar crop of kids doing similar things, similar days per week, most things were still constant, and it seemed like the amount of heavy loads they were pushing and pulling and holding, just the tension flowing through their elbows, was just fatiguing them out, where then the pitching was probably too much.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can, I don't know, people go bananas with one thing. Like, oh, I'm doing great, I'm feeling great, barbell bench pressing and trap deadlifting 650, you know, in February when the season's about to start. It's like, okay, like, you're brand new to this. Let's see how you feel once you've done that, once you've trained 50 kids that way. And see how, like, that aggregated amount of people respond to that. They're probably not going to respond to it as well as maybe you do. Or, I don't know. So, there's anomalies. But, good episode here.
Yes.
On Twinsies.
For our 50th.
Pickles. Speed reading. Textbooks.
Yep.
Elbows.
Med ball push-ups.
Here's to the next 50.
Here's to the next 50.